It's Saturday, April 8th, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Lubbock, Texas. Hello, good afternoon from a beautiful Saturday afternoon in Lubbock, Texas. And this podcast will be a rebroadcast of a really impromptu and informal session with several friends of mine from the University of Nebraska at Omaha who had discovered Google Earth at the Florida Educational Technology Conference a couple weeks ago. And I just was in awe of all that they had learned and just how much fun they had had. And I really think that we are at the very, very tip of amazing connections and resources and tools that people are going to connect data and media to geography through Google Earth and other tools like this. So I'll include in the podcast show notes some links to several of the resources they talk about, the avian bird flu, a KML file for taking a look at that, also the live airport and aircraft tracking information, as well as the social bookmarks that I have started to create on Delicious for Google Earth. If you have other Google Earth resources that you have found, that you find or think would be great instructionally, I would encourage you to email them to me or let me know about them. Actually, the best way to do that is using Delicious, the social bookmark site, because at the time you create a social bookmark, you can actually add the word for and a colon, and then the username of another Delicious user, and that will automatically go into their inbox for them to take a look at. So my Delicious account is W. Fryer, so if you find a resource and you're going to tag that with Delicious, just put F-O-R for colon and then W, F-R-Y-E-R, and I will get that and be able to check that out and appreciate the opportunity to network with you on tools like this, which, again, are connecting media and data, text and information, to geography and to places on planet Earth.
All right, we're here at FETC in Orlando, and I'm here with Mark, Bob, and Paul, who have been spending their evening playing with Google Earth because
three,
they have
3 hours
just discovered amazing things that they're going to talk about. So what do we know how to do now on Google Earth that we didn't know before?
Well, there's a special kind of file type.
United 150, climb and maintain 15,000. Contact departure now, 124.
So are we looking at a live image of
live
aircraft?
Image using Google Earth of flight paths and every airline that's flying into O'Hare.
Isn't that a little scary for terrorist possibilities?
Grab my laptop there and I'll show you some stuff.
And then, so you can see all the flight patterns and how they collect together and get in. And if you look really close, see that?
Oh,
and
my
god! It's all right into O'Hare. And you can see them starting to circle around O'Hare so they can get the right flight patterns to get the right runway.
Now, how do you know this is live? Or this
because
is
it refreshes current? Every minute.
What?
And it's going out and streaming. It's streaming that in right now.
And so this is public data?
I'm assuming it's public data, and it's not just tracking United or American or whatever. It's tracking FedEx, it's tracking private planes that have tracking patterns, private companies that have tracking patterns, anything that is monitored by FAA.
American Airline 2064, maintain 460 knots, maintain heading 167. Contact Chicago departure now, 124.7. Good day, sir.
And you click on any airplane, and it tells you what flight number it is, where it's coming from, where it's going, what's its altitude, and what's its speed at that time.
I could track butterflies in the United Kingdom.
You see it just moved?
Yeah.
The whole thing just moved.
This is a layer that you have put on top of Google Earth by importing this file type?
Actually, we clicked on a website, and it says...
FBO.
I don't know how much I want to disclose, but a website that said below, look at the real-time 3D views of all current inbound flights to the airport. So click on the Google Earth and it'll show you all that.
And so just like you'd click to add, subscribe this in iTunes or whatever's a podcast, click that and it becomes a new Google Earth option for you.
Right.
Here are all the recent outbreaks of avian flu. We're tracking them around the globe.
Not many in the Pacific.
Not many.
Not many bird flus in the Pacific.
Not many in South America either, actually.
North America.
But check out
check out Africa.
Oh, wow.
But then check out Europe and Asia.
Oh, wow. So we're talking about geographic information systems technology to the people. I don't think so.
That was Mark.
Yeah, live.
Other things, we overlay, you know, graphical, well, weather maps on the fly.
Live cloud data?
Live cloud data.
Hurricane data, typhoon data.
All with the click of a button. And so we did a search on Google finding KLM files in a URL address. And currently today it popped up 245,000.
And you see that I've
searches.
Been playing with about 25 of them.
So once you have that KML file, that's what you import into Google that gives you the data and that has a URL in it that's going out to get live stuff.
And actually, here's one called GPS Visualizer that lets you create your own KML files on the fly. So for instance, one thing I have done here is I wanted to see what the snow cover was like in Nebraska, and so it generated a file from a satellite image, current satellite image, and overlaid it over the Google Earth image of Nebraska.
Wow. So is this like a Photoshop, you know, multi-layer file sort of thing where you click to
you turn the layers
turn
on,
layers
turn
on and off?
Yep.
Exactly.
And I can turn on airplanes and turn off airplanes.
Individual airplanes.
Right. And I can, you know, if I click on it, it'll actually zoom me into that airplane. If I click on EGF 437, there it is. But if I click on it, I'll go to a different one. This one, that one's in there. If I click on it, it'll take me across and zoom in just like I'm flying with it.
So you see.
What? Sorry.
See how that one's actually taxiing on the runway right now.
Oh my god!
And then when I tilt up, watch me tilt.
What's this?
This is awesome. See the purple tracking lines? Oh, where'd my purple tracking lines go? Oh, it just refreshed it. So now I gotta find a different airplane. Oh, that one's just about ready to land. See how far it. If I click on that, I can see its altitude, 600 feet. I caught it midair. It has this much to land.
Oh, whoa! Oh my god!
There's my tracking pattern in the last minute, and then the purple line goes out. There's another one landing over here in this runway.
Now, is this only available for O'Hare?
There's actually, in our case, there was 2, 4, 6, 7. This particular website had
Los Angeles,
7.
Boston, Chicago, Atlanta. JFK is New York. MIA is Miami.
Seattle. And I downloaded all of those in Google, and so I can turn them on and off as I want to.
The speed of.
See, I can turn.
Collecting new data has changed. Data collection.
Oh.
And you know, you raised a valid question, Terrace.
Yeah.
We have it. Do you think somebody's sitting somewhere is looking at flight patterns so they can sit in a car somewhere?
Oh, yeah.
Don't be a negative Nelly.
Well, he's got a valid point.
If you're working for the Homeland Security, please discontinue this podcast now. Wow.
But the tilt is way cool in a way of seeing how high it is. See,
because this has three, yeah, it's 3D.
3D.
It's 3D with all the flight paths.
Right.
Now, some of this is 3D also as far as you being able to fly through, right?
None of it is. I mean, ultimately I find underneath that airplane because I can get below, you know, 1,000 feet.
But weren't you guys saying that, like, in New York you could do a fly-through or something like that?
I mean, you have that potential. Like, in, you know, they built a campus 3D mapping.
So you go to the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
So here.
And do a 3D.
I'm flying over University of Nebraska at Omaha. And our Information Science Technology College built a 3D model of our campus. And so when I tilt on our campus, I also have the height of my building.
Oh, my gosh.
And so if I get
we just need
close
a little gold
enough,
star right there.
No, and again, this is just something that you've clicked on. So if you weren't doing this, then that would look the same as all the other area around.
So if I unclick that, there's my ultimately 2D building.
There's the 2D picture.
When I click on it and make it active, I become 3D. And if I get zoomed in enough, let me get back to not tilt, and I zoom in, Let me back up here a little bit. I zoom in, pull back a little bit. Now I'm basically, there's right, and I tilt. There I am, 3D on the height of the buildings. So really, they're looking at not just latitude and longitude, but also elevation.
So did they use GPS and surveying equipment to do this?
I have no idea.
We don't know.
We've been doing this for 3 hours only.
But I think the most important thing is discovery learning and asking that what if question. And I think
exactly.
In education classes, that's what we're missing.
We're constructing our own new knowledge as we go right now.
But I think students forget that what if question. They want to know all the answers.
Right. What do I need to know for the test?
We don't know.
If we don't know.
Landing path's going from Chicago's up here and it's going this way.
Northwest.
Can you tell by the landing pattern which wind direction is it currently in Chicago?
Well, it's how they're crabbed in the wind.
They always land into the wind and they always take off.
Right, right.
And so you can tell what direction the wind is at O'Hare.
Right.
By just looking at the flight patterns and which direction all the planes are turning to get down.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
So your inspiration for this was a session you went to today, right?
The session at FETCS.
And were they showing this kind of stuff, or what did they show in the session?
Actually, they showed us a little bit of other stuff. And
yeah, another cool thing is like distance, you know, for math. And we talked a lot about math at FETC.
It was the John Kuglin session. It was excellent.
If I come out here and I turn on tools, measure, and I want to know how long our campus is, I just click here on one edge of campus.
Oh, look at this.
Draw a line across this side of campus. And if I walk all the way across campus, it's 0.57 miles.
Because there's a web tool called Google Panameter, which will do that, but I didn't realize you could do that right within the Google Earth client.
Right, and there's geometric.
You make measure areas as well?
I believe so.
GPS device. Can you do GPS device, or is that the upgrade? Yeah,
that's the plus.
You gotta
that's
buy
the $20
plus,
add-on.
Which I think might be well worth it.
And so what does that mean? If you have a GPS, then it connects to your computer, and so you map your own points? Or
I think it says manufacture the GPS device, turn the device on, and click the OK button. I think you can interface your GPS with Google Earth, and wherever you are, you can tell exactly which latitude and longitude and elevation.
Or I wonder if you can plan routes, or if you...
I bet you could do anything. I don't know. It's a good question.
Basically, that would let you go into the field. Okay, so we're going to write an NSF grant that'll get STEM money and solve the math and science crisis
there
in the United States using Google Earth.
And
right?
Then China won't eat our lunch.
That's right. And then what's William Willard Daggett going to do? And who's going to go to his conference when we've solved all these problems?
That's right.
We'll have a good old time doing it, too.
So what did you just find?
Well, this just says new Earth Observatory. It's a NASA website, and it's a KML file that has new images of Earth. It's taking a while to download, so I'm not sure if it's going to work. But
And we're at a nice hotel modem. No.
56K wireless.
No.
Yeah,
no.
56K has never been so much fun.
Now, tell me about the Google search that you did to get this, because you did an advanced Google search.
Right, I just did a Google search, and I just made sure that the file type was KML, and that KML was in the URL as well, and boom, 245,000 hits.
But don't you only have a CANS number of extensions that you can do? Was KML one of the choices?
KML, KMZ, and I tell you what, I was going to go to Google and say define KML, but I have not.
We've been too busy discovering.
Playing with what we found on the first hit. We've been hit that for 3 hours. I'm only on the second page of 245,000
hits. Hey, this is what being excited about educational technology and going to
Paul, tell us about. Tell us about, you know, we were sitting here tonight and you said this is an event.
Well, yeah, this is one of those events that you'll remember for a long time. The last time I really got this excited was when, actually, there's been other times that this was real reminiscent of the time that Paul Lindgren, Westside High School teacher, and I first discovered how to in Unix go do file type BIN and go to NASA and download pictures in an old Unix account of some of the planetary stuff. But that was 15 years ago, so it's been a while since we've had something really this much fun.
So, Paul, you're one person who can kind of put this in context because you've worked with all kinds of NASA maps and data. What were those tools that you used, and how does this tool compare to what you were able to do then?
Well, this is pretty amazing. Just 3 or 4 years ago, what we can do with Google Earth, we would have to have a supercomputer to be able to do these type of flybys. And if we were doing a flyby, we'd actually let it render for hours and hours and hours to do the flyby. This is doing it live on a streaming website right now. Plus, we're adding layers. We're adding our own information. We're picking out what we want.
And there's three of us simultaneously in the same hotel room within 3 feet of each other.
On the same network.
On the same network, pulling that data down live.
And
three different things doing three different ways.
And we're all, you're doing airplane stuff. I'm not as interested in that. I'm looking more at
and I'm on a PC and you guys are on a Mac, and it makes absolutely no difference whatsoever.
Visible satellite imagery and
you're doing biology stuff, the bird flu.
I'm just all over the map right now.
Mark, what have you been tracking? Are you doing aircraft?
Airline. And I'm just thinking about the whole map conceptualization and how we can apply that into the classroom. You know, with whether it's wind, whether it's measurement, whether it's, you know, clouds and science, and I'm writing down some details for a future presentation.
Absolutely. And the thing that occurs to me about this tool is this is a tool that the teacher would be utilizing creatively with students to create projects whose ultimate definition may not be determined at the beginning, right?
Right.
I mean, what we're used to in schools, certainly in Texas and maybe Nebraska too, is really canned and scripted curriculum, which is, here's the lesson, here's what you're going to do,
right,
here's what the kids are going to do, everyone's going to do it the same, it's going to look this way, and you're going to get this grade. Using a tool like this, you're talking about a very different curricular model, where we're going to use this powerful tool to, you know, ask questions about phenomena or something. Why is that big red thing on the top of the Earth?
It's loading an image right now. This is Earth at night.
And ultimately, you know, here's a tool called Google Earth that's free. You present Google Earth to the students in the classroom. Here's some resources. Here's some URLs. Here's some overlying questions. You find the details.
And it could be used as a way to help them get background knowledge, and then also take the knowledge that they have farther. I mean, obviously, they're going to need to know some things. But the cool thing about this is it can be their neighborhood, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
They don't have to be talking about New York City when they live in Texas and they know nothing about New York City.
As long as they have stripped images, that's good enough to see.
Well, and you know what? The thing that kids always want to see is, where's my backyard?
Right.
Where's my house? And where's my grandparents'
house?
Where
does grandma live?
And as long as they don't live in a tool rule of an area, but I believe in a short period of time, all of those images, no matter where you live in the United States, will be loaded.
Now, what did you say about strip image or something like that? What does that mean?
Well, as satellites take that imagery, it takes those imagery in strips. And so when you really back out of Google Earth, you can see strips across the map that are high resolution compared to low resolution images.
And so we've got parts of the United States that only have low res coverage?
Right, like a lot of rural areas have low imagery. So you can see right here where it changes from green,
right,
high res, low res.
That's where the satellite took a strip that went right down that
part
of the Earth.
And the further side, zoom out, you know, and ultimately there's probably a satellite for all that stuff. It's just that Google hasn't purchased that yet.
Or just
to load it up, or the programmers haven't loaded that all information in the databases.
Ultimately, what do you think Google is doing in terms of releasing all this stuff for free to the public? There is an income model with them buying the plus thing, and then you can get this professional, you know, several hundred dollar thing. What do you think this is?
Because I'd be interested, you know, like when you turn on locations for lodging or locations to eat, you know, who's advertising and where's that money coming from? You know, if I choose, I need to find hotels in Orlando.
Yeah.
And all these hotels show up.
Right.
Is it every hotel, or is it just hotels that pay to some subscription?
Right. Well, and today when you do a Google search, then you'll see the sponsored links and those kind of things on the top. The cool thing about this, hey, have you done anything with sea temperatures or anything with...
Not yet, but
it's
tides?
It's funny. Well, what is it? 10:15 here, and we've been hot on this for about an hour and 15 minutes.
Because I'm thinking one of the coolest parts about that, I mean, what you're saying with hotels, it's kind of human inputted or whatever, but the things where we've got, you know, sensors that are out there,
right,
you know, what is the what's the surf, what's the sea temperature, you know, that kind of data. As far as the modeling of meteorology, I mean, and this is a fascinating question. One of the people I met last summer is a meteorologist at OU. They've got a great severe storm lab. And, you know, there's a big debate in meteorology about if you can get more data points, can you make exact models?
Right.
And some people that say no. The weather system is not only dynamical, it's chaotic, and you're not, even if you have a data point, every inch of the Earth going to exactly predict it. But I can see this being incredibly cool to be able to track things, even like seismographic stuff, like if we were looking at fault lines, you know, or volcanoes.
By the way, I did find current earthquake data.
Right, and where is there any active earthquakes going on right now?
Well, let's take a look and see.
Or active hurricanes.
So
or active volcanoes.
So you just double-click that file, and it automatically brought it into Google Earth.
And it's going out now, and it's going to
trying
start
to
looking.
Trying to download that data.
I'm having trouble getting to the NASA website today, but let's go take a look at that one.
Oh, that's geocaches for a particular area that somebody's loaded up?
Well, this is actually, I believe this is Pasadena. So I'm assuming this is JPL.
So you said one of them was about building your own files.
Oh, that's this GPS visualizer.
So is that a whole assignment that students could do too, to devise some kind of geographic information that they could measure and put into a file that other people could get? Or how?
Let's just take a look here and see. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to this GPS. I'm going to refresh this so that what I'm doing is refreshing so that it's going to give me the overlay data that I can possibly get for this area. I believe this is Pasadena. I'm not really sure. And for instance, I might want to get the current 250 meter satellite imagery. I might want to get Landsat imagery. I might want to get Tiger maps that has roads, or I might want to get a topographic map. So if I click this GPS visualizer goes right out, creates that file for me. And network has slowed down a little bit. I think it's a little slower on this side of the room. I was having better luck on the other side of the room, guys. But
your Google Earth overlay is being created.
Being created for me. Here it is. It's created this for me.
So you're saying the clicks that you made,
it's
like specified layers that you want to see.
Exactly.
And now there's a new file.
And this website has gone out now and created that for me. I'm downloading it.
And I shut mine down so yours can get faster.
All right. Thank you very much.
I think that's going to work.
And the bad part of this is we were going to go to bed early because we have to get up early, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning to get to the airport, but we might just as well stay up all night.
I'm doing,
so we don't miss the plane.
Hey, we'll watch our plane come in.
That's right.
We can see if our plane is here.
Hey,
we might
know, and if we stay up all night and see that it's late, then, you know.
We might have a chance to maybe sleep.
That's right.
See, and now look, here's the map that's just loaded into Google Earth.
Whoa. So it's overlaid.
A topographic map. So even though I have terrain turned on now, if I go and slide this way, I don't know if it's going to wrap over that or not.
But it's also cool why he's doing that is the translucent layer.
It actually is. You see, it's still got that 3D effect to it.
Oh my gosh!
Isn't that cool?
This is unbelievable.
Isn't it?
I mean, talk about a geographer's dream.
Well, not only that, but let me show you something else I did here earlier.
But I think about the mathematicians behind this, though, and really, even though Stephen might not have been as good as we thought he was.
You mean John?
Our last keynote?
Yeah. Was it Stephen?
I don't remember.
Think about the mathematics behind all that modeling that takes place to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, but also the translation, too, because I agree that we're going to always need mathematicians and engineers, but one of the things tools like this do is it brings all of this to the fingertips of folks that don't have to have all of those math skills, but yet they can apply their creative abilities to think about solving problems and asking questions and finding answers that without those tools, they wouldn't even be able, they could ask the question rhetorically, but it might not occur to them to ask the question. I don't know, because when you see all this and what's possible,
it's
like, where does it go?
Well, unfortunately, I deleted this one that I had been working on, but I had set this up so that I had Nebraska zoomed in, and I went out to the Library of Congress, American Memory website, and I found a map of Nebraska, the Union Pacific Railroad land grant across Nebraska in the 1850s or 60s, and I overlaid it over Nebraska. And so on Google Earth, then, when I click that layer, suddenly I have a historical map of Nebraska in the 1850s wrapped all over this map, and I can see where the land grants were for the Union Pacific Railroad. I was also able to get another map that showed all of the railroads in Nebraska in the 1890s. And so we were able to, and in fact, I think I could probably go out, if I wanted to, I could get the journals of Lewis and Clark, Clark and Lewis, actually. And
had to get that in,
had to get that in there, and overlay that as well. So I could build these layers of historical maps. Now, the other thing we haven't even started playing with is we can actually, one of the things I want to see is, what if I could put RSS feeds in here somehow so I can actually get current news about a geographic location. So I click on it, and up comes the current news from
that place. And I'm thinking of the whole place-based digital storytelling connection that Joe Lambert talked about.
Exactly.
You know, in Toronto, they're recording stories that are associated with particular places. Or you think about the American Memory Project in Washington, D.C. Wouldn't it be cool, and isn't it possible now, for you to have that as a layer that you bring in?
Exactly.
And so it would be hyperlinked. Okay, let's go to Washington, D.C., and let's say we're going to be doing a walking tour of this area. Right here on our computer, we can click here and listen to stories about these particular places, or this even goes to the next level with your mobile device.
Right.
And okay, now I'm taking my iPod generation 50, you know, and so I have those stories, you know, I don't know, people are already doing some of that, I guess, just with, you know, podcasts.
But. Or here I am, I'm taking a virtual trip along the Oregon Trail, and at some spot I click and I read a journal entry from that spot.
Or a diary that was created there.
And here's a basic thing that I've thought of as I'm driving across the country with our family. You know how the historical markers are out there?
Mm-hmm.
And it's great when we can stop and see them and read them.
Right.
Usually we're in too big of a hurry.
Hurry,
but
right.
I'm thinking, I'd like that on my at my fingertips. I'd like, not that hey, I just want to be in a rat race.
Let's get out and look at
yeah.
something that you
the only problem is,
to.
In your car, are you going to have a high band?
Well, but couldn't you get it in advance? You plot your route.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be going mm-hmm. on, you know, highway
sure.
so-and-so,
yep.
and then let me download those because
right.
that would tell you if you want to get out.
Right.
Holy cow, look what happened here and, you know, so-and-so.
Right.
Let's get out and look at this, or let's look at the ruins of, you know, such-and-such.
And if you're interested in that, you'd be more likely to get out someone that isn't interested in that.
And that could possibly be a collaborative project because if you created something where you invited people, hey, are there historical markers in your area? Then this is the kind of data we need you to input into our database. This is
exactly.
where it fits
well,
all into databases, you know, and then is somehow searchable, queryable, and downloadable in the same way that you're creating these custom files that overlay.
Exactly.
Wow.
It's just really fun.
It's endless. I mean, we could be here all night.
Okay, so I need you guys to email me these links.
Well, now you know how to do it. File type.
So the actual syntax is
file type
colon KML space NURL colon KML space.
Then I put in NASA because I wanted to see what NASA had available to KML files, and so.
Wow.
So really, we haven't had any specific URLs except Google finding URLs of
we have
KMLs.
Really.
Well, that one that you just built, though, was big, and you just had with the tracking would be cool as far as...
And actually, I did not build that. Someone else has coded that in. You
right.
know, and
you
and
just pick what you want,
took
and
a look
it creates
at some
the
of
code.
These KML files, and what's interesting is it's just a script. I could see high school kids creating these themselves.
The scripts
themselves.
Or the KML files.
The KML files. Because I just opened it up in BBEdit, and it popped right open, and I mean, it's just a script.
Huh.
Let's see what this one does.
And I think it's amazing that it works cross-platform, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, it works as smooth on either platform.
Yay, Google.
No, here,
I was afraid they weren't going to do that.
Look at this.
So that's live cloud data of Central America.
Yeah, this is actually...
You know, what this makes me think of, too, is that cluster maps that I showed you that maps the location of people pulling up a web page. And so you could probably use the same technology. There's a little JavaScript that they have that every time the page loads, it's grabbing the IP mm-hmm. address and it's tossing it into a database, and then it's doing a geographic representation of where
what
that IP address is.
From.
Yeah, but you could do a more sophisticated way of tracking that, because that just gives you dots on a small map.
Mm.
But like this, where you could zoom in, I mean, you could see, oh, wow, look, that's Tegucigalpa, Honduras. That's, you know,
Upper Hayford, England, or wherever
right.
it would happen to be.
So I'm going to do a search here for.
So we definitely can see rich possibilities for staff development and teachers.
Oh, absolutely.
Hmm. But you think teachers are going to get excited about this in our current environment of testing and curriculum and everything?
I mean, I think if you can, there's several hundred standards that you can just apply to every single example we've talked about tonight. I mean, it really is endless. I mean, once you apply two or three things to that single thing, you could probably learn more on that, 15 minutes of what if than trying to have a structured page 17 through page 22 of a book.
Right. That's a different way of looking at education, though, but it's a much more engaging way of looking at it, just if you think about. And this is something somebody commented on in the Skype cast we had last week, is the thrill, wanting students to experience that thrill. I mean, the excitement that you all have now about this tool and what you're able to see mm-hmm. and do, you want kids to experience that same thrill and motivation mm-hmm. and then also want to carry it on their own. Not like, 3:00, got to go home, we're done.
Well, I mean, think about what we as adults did tonight. We were really one-to-one initiative. And we were playing, but we were also learning and we were discovering.
We're being very constructivist right now.
But we had the one-to-one, and we'll take one-to-one in the classroom
right.
to make the same thing.
Does everyone have their own machine?
Or does cooperative groups work? We could have been a cooperative group and done this, but we didn't.
But we were cooperative.
We were all interested in our own thing, but we were all saying, hey, look at this, check this out. It was very much that.
It was cooperative because we learned from each other.
You were feeding off of each other.
But at the same time, we were doing our own thing.
That's right.
You were able to pursue. Which is what the guy we saw yesterday, Paul, talked about as far as kids wanting control of information and
right.
getting used
exactly.
to controlling the way the information comes to them, but then coming to school frustrated because they are offered no control. So
right.
this is an engaging environment to a large extent because you had control over information.
Right.
You could decide whether that was a path to follow or whether you wanted to dump that. And
I can just hear the hum in a classroom right now. Not the hum of the computers, but the hum of the students talking to each other
yeah.
about, hey, check this out. Hey, check that out. Hey, how'd you get to that? Hey, what was that URL? Hey, what'd you do there? Hey.
Yeah, and this is almost where the teacher has to get out of the way of the learning.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to be important to facilitate it and structure it and give it direction. But if the kids have these kind of tools and a pathway that allows them to have that choice and creativity, I think you're right. You're going to have to get out of the way as they take off and.
Mm-hmm. I think just as adults here too, we have to play a while in order to become structured.
Yep.
And I think we don't have enough time for our students to play a little bit in order to refine and structure that activity.
Right.
We just go straight to the structure and no playtime.
Right.
And so we seem to do opposite in education. We structure and then say, oh, if you get this structure done, now you can play. I think maybe we can think about that the opposite way.
Now let's note that Paul just did a Google search in which he got 4 hits. Now that doesn't occur very often anymore.
Well, actually what I'm doing is I'm looking for very specific things. I was kind of looking for Aztec and Maya ruins that I might be able to see here. I'm sure I could find other stuff, but I'm just sort of experimenting right now to see exactly what I can find.
So Google is really the portal into the world of information using a search syntax that allows you to powerfully distill just what you want.
As long as someone has created it already. If it doesn't exist, I may have to figure out how to make that out myself.
And ruins is one of those that is kind of hit and miss. Right, Paul?
Yeah. And something else I had counted on is translate this page.
The ruins don't all happen in English?
I am afraid there might be someone else doing this besides us English-speaking folk.
There are a few million other folks on the planet that don't speak English as a primary language. So if kids are going to be able to play and teachers are, schools are going to have to restructure their day. I mean, there's no way around that, is there?
But the other part, though, is there enough technology in the classrooms to facilitate this? Or will the students get as excited with a projector and one computer in the classroom?
No.
They won't because they can't do their own thing. It'll be too structured.
Right.
So in the big picture, I think it's going to take infrastructure as well as technology, you know, not necessarily one-to-one, but group-to-one to really make this, you know, happen.
Right. But this would be, these would be the types of explorations that you could do. This is level two type stuff. This isn't, this kind of stuff isn't possible with traditional tools, with the textbook and pencils.
Right.
So this is the type of very, very creative, very dynamic, very engaging and motivating lessons that would be possible in a one-to-one environment with the type of infrastructure, like we said, for bandwidth,
mm-hmm.
And with the teacher structuring the learning and the learning task or the learning environment. But it would be about structuring the environment, right?
Right.
You would have to have an environment where the kids are able to work independently and where they're able to work together
cooperatively.
And cooperatively. And it seems like it would all be about the environment. The learning task is important, but if the environment and the culture and the relationships and all that, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that would have to be in place. You couldn't just dump this lesson on top of a class that had been doing traditional drill and kill, you know, since the start of school.
I think in my old way I used to teach vector analysis and physics. And now with these planes, because the ground speed that was listed here is not the true air speed, but yet if somebody in a small group setting could go get weather.com and get the winds aloft and find out what direction the wind is blowing and what the speed is, knowing that piece of information through vector analysis, I'm convinced they could determine what the true airspeed of that aircraft is at one moment in time.
Mm-hmm. Because you'd be able to combine the vector component
mm-hmm.
of the wind with
mm-hmm.
the aircraft and
right.
do addition or subtraction.
It puts new meaning to if an airplane leaves Seattle going east,
right.
at 300.
What heading does it have to? Sure.
Well,
and an airplane heading west from Boston, what does that mean?
But these
why do you have to know? Because you just watch and see when they meet.
Watch them when they crash.
How much fuel will a jet use on a trip from Seattle to Chicago based upon these parameters that you determine?
Well, I'm reminded of this David Jonathan from Missouri talking about ill-structured and well-structured. There's all kinds of ill-structured problems
right. mm-hmm.
that you could challenge kids with. Like take the bird flu thing that you were doing. Well, what kinds of conclusions can we draw about this bird flu? And, I mean, that is ill-structured, right? We
mm-hmm.
don't know where the bird flu is going to go. I don't know
yeah,
a lot
don't
about
know if
it,
it's
period.
Exponential?
Yeah.
Maybe linear?
But as far as the whole geographic
mm-hmm.
component, that's where the GIS
right.
lets you see a problem in a qualitatively different way because it's being represented in geographic terms.
And that wasn't represented over time, though, was it, Paul? That was just current data.
Was that?
The
bird flu.
Stuff.
Oh, that was actually it was there was historical data as well.
Right, because there was different colors based on
right.
how long
and
when
it occurred, and so you track where it's moving, how it's moving.
You found the road of the Incas?
I found something. Somebody's with their. I saw a GPS.
Somebody crashed.
Mm-hmm. I just restarted.
Now, what this is, I found actually someone's personal travel log here.
Oh, look, he's got a Google. A big old Google
face.
Yeah, a Google, what is that, a map pin?
Yeah.
A Google pointer.
But no, this is something else. What is this, Zodo?
Well, what this was I did, if we go back to Google Earth, this is a
pop-up.
Oh,
Camino
okay.
del Inca, this
so,
is the road of the
yeah,
Incas.
Yeah, they linked the picture they took to geographic information.
Right.
So you were able to click on that and then immediately go to pictures of that place.
That person had taken.
To a website.
So that's what they're talking about with Flickr or these other things
right.
where you can add geographic information. So the cell phone of the future, which will be the ultimate
mm-hmm.
digital camera, as mine already is for me, will not only record the time and the sort of camera, but it will record the GPS coordinates where you
took it,
and when you automatically upload it to Flickr, then it will be instantly queryable by a database so that, you know, all of us can be touring New Zealand with Discovery Education,
right.
taking pictures, and then everybody can immediately be seeing the pictures that we're taking because they're geographically mapped to the with GPS.
Was it Dan Buter? Was that the person that was traveled across the bicycle?
Across Africa?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't remember his name.
But it was the fellow that was
mm-hmm.
doing educational journals, mm-hmm. web entries. But think about how that would influence today's trip compared to what just a
well,
couple years
Discovery
ago.
Discovery Education just called a teacher who's in Australia right now, and he's in New Jersey. He had applied to be for work for the Travel Channel, and he didn't get picked. But they called him and said, hey, we'd like you to take this trip across Australia, and we're going to have kids online filling out online surveys to figure out where you're going to go, and you're going to blog, and you're going to take pictures, and you're going to video conference with them. And then after that, we want you to go to New Zealand.
Right.
I mean, they're doing that right now.
Right.
But, yeah, what does that trip mean today with technology, and then what's that going to mean in 5 years?
Right.
And, ultimately, what's going to engage kids?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think we're excited about a lot of this stuff because we have interest in it. I mean, you're doing Oregon Trail. You're interested in the, you know, Union Pacific land grants across Nebraska, you know, the whole thing
curious.
About aircraft. Yeah, I know, but those are because those are historical, you know, interests
yeah.
and passions.
And hobbies and interests.
Yeah, and so how do you get those kinds of things cultivated, I guess, in the minds of less mature and less experienced people?
But, I mean, I think you just had, you have a hook. I mean, if you have 20 students in your class, and you know them well enough to have their interests. Everyone has an interest. You just have to hook them the right interest. I mean, like, for example, Mark here with his without a cable modem at home tonight at this table says, I'm going home and getting cable modem at my house because my interest has just been piqued to a point that I'm done. I need to do it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, so this is the same thing with students. If you can give them the hook,
right,
it lasts a lifetime.
Right. And that's the real challenge of engagement, is getting kids. I mean, it's going to be different for many kids. One hook may work for a lot of kids, but it's not going to work for every kid.
Right.
But that's the challenge of teaching. That's the challenge of differentiated instruction. Yeah, is how am I going to differentiate this so Mark's engaged and Paul's engaged and Bob's engaged and, you know, we're all learning, but, you know, It's not all going to look the same.
In person, I'm going to be engaged on my pillows.
That's right. Well, thank you guys for letting us record this, and we'll sign off
signing off
from Orlando.
Adios.
Amigos.